Hello, this is Jim Michaley, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the August 18th issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. First up, let's look at the front page. Here's a story titled, As Iran Truce Expires and Options Shrivel, Trump Lashes Out. Piece is written by Luke Broadwater, who's a White House correspondent, reporting from Washington. President Trump took aim at Oman, a U.S. ally that has been mediating the talks, as efforts to end a war he started have faltered. As a crumbling truce with Iran officially collapsed on Monday, President Trump signaled his frustration at his inability to resolve a war that he started but cannot seem to end. In an interview with Fox News, the president lashed out at an American ally, Oman, that has been trying to mediate negotiations with Iran. If Oman gets in the way, we'll bomb the shit out of them, Mr. Trump said in a phone interview, according to Fox News' Trey Yingst. The latest threat toward Oman, which has facilitated talks between the United States and Iran for years and maintains that it is still a neutral mediator, came as Mr. Trump found himself without much leverage to reach the goals he set out at the start of the war. I think ultimately his threats against Oman are just a reflection of his frustration with the situation he's created, where he has no good options, said Nate Swanson of the Atlantic Council's Iran Strategy Project. He's just reflexively lashing out, and this time Oman got in the crosshairs. Hostilities have now stretched past the six-month mark in a conflict that began with the United States and Israel launching strikes across Iran in February. Administration officials pledged at that time that the war would be over in 4 to 6 weeks. On the battlefield, the United States has struck thousands of targets in Iran and dealt serious blows to the country's military capabilities, but the president has struggled to achieve the war's political objectives. In June, the two sides agreed to a memorandum of understanding, but that quickly fell apart. Both Mr. Trump and Iran's leaders have said the deal is essentially dead. It is mostly symbolic, but symbols matter, Justin Logan, the director of defense and foreign policy studies at the Cato Institute, said of the expiration of the Memorandum of Understanding. He emphasized that the main function of the agreement was to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, the critical shipping lane in the Persian Gulf that Iran effectively closed during the war. The tragic part here is that the United States is clawing to try to get back to the state of the Middle East before the war started, he said. As the ceasefire officially expires, the president and his team have promised to level crushing sanctions against Iran this week, though the details of those plans have yet to be unveiled. And Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has said the United States can maintain a naval blockade of the Strait of Hormuz indefinitely, an acknowledgement that there was no end to the war in sight. In the Fox News interview, Mr. Trump sought to project patience, saying he was not in a hurry to secure a deal, while maintaining that his central goal remained preventing Iran from possessing a nuclear weapon. Speaking to the reporters in the Oval Office, Mr. Trump was asked whether he was any closer to ending the war now than he was when the Memorandum of Understanding was agreed to. The president did not directly answer, but claimed that Iran wants to, quote, make a deal, but they're not going to make the kind of a deal that I feel is necessary, unquote. He added, look, we're in there for one reason. Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. Mr. Trump also downplayed concerns that sailors on the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln have been deployed for too long with conditions worsening. The ship is supporting U.S. operations in the Middle East against Iran. Mr. Trump called reports of food shortages on the ship fake news. The Lincoln has been out there for a period of time, good period of time, but over the years we've had him out there much longer, the president said. Mr. Trump also said the United States could declare the Strait of Hormuz a territory of the United States. We control it with the blockade, and I like the idea of declaring it a territory, he said. But it was Oman that received the president's fury on Monday. Iran has said that it has been holding talks with Oman on temporarily reopening the strait. I don't think they behaved very well, he said of the U.S. ally, but it would handle them very easily, just like we do other things. It was the second time this year the president has threatened the country. In May, it emerged that Oman had discussed working with Iran to charge fees for ships to pass through the strait. Oman will behave just like everybody else, or we'll have to blow them up, Mr. Trump told reporters then. They understand that. They'll be fine. A White House official did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Mr. Swanson said he believed the president had several options to try to resolve the war. He said the United States could continue with a policy of what Mr. Trump has called low-key economic pressure, which has thus far not produced results. Ramp up a military campaign against Iran, even as U.S. munition stockpiles dwindle, or return to negotiations to produce a deal similar to the one both sides already abandoned. Or, he said, Mr. Trump could wash his hands completely of the entire war and ask Gulf allies to get more involved in the Strait of Hormuz. I'm wondering if at some point, either by choice or incompetence, we kind of just put our blinders on and let the Gulf figure it out, Mr. Swanson said. Next up, gas station becomes an improvised relief center after Hawaii's storm. In a remote region of the ravaged Big Island, there were community gas runs, donated turkey stuffing, a makeshift emergency broadcast, and even a helicopter. The dead zone was demarcated by rows of cars idling on dangerously narrow highway shoulders near the Ocean View Market. Hurricane Lala had torn through the Kauai district on the southern tip of Hawaii's Big Island 2 days earlier, and farther down the winding two-lane mountain road were thousands of people in rural communities. Most were still without electricity, mobile phone service, and gas 2 days after the storm. So the residents of Ocean View, a remote community of fewer than 5,000, had taken matters into their own hands. On Monday, the parking lot of the Ocean View Market gas station, just off Route 11, was teeming with locals looking for help and looking to help others. Shortly after Hawaii's worst storm in years, residents had spontaneously organized to provide information, commodities, and even air support. The front entrance was locked and the gas pumps were inoperable. But the store had become an impromptu disaster relief center, complete with a mobile radio station run by Tim Reed, an Ocean View resident who hooked up his computer to a satellite to run the broadcast. "We're the emergency communication for Ocean View," Mr. Reed said in an interview. Usually he plays Hawaiian music and classic rock for listeners in his corner of the island on a low-power FM station. Today, though, he was spreading the word about the resources on offer in the gas station parking lot. One was his Starlink terminals for those hoping to connect to the internet via satellite and make calls to the outside world. Mr. Reed, 55, sat in a wheelchair at a plastic table next to Karen Field, 58, who was helping him broadcast. They took turns on the matchbook-sized wireless microphone. "We have a few more announcements to make," Ms. Field said into the microphone. "We have some gracious volunteers that are going around doing wellness checks for seniors." Hurricane Lala, which was a Category 1 storm, did not make landfall but wrecked highways, ravaged homes, toppled trees, and knocked out power for much of the island. On the Big Island, the coastal town of Pahala, with about 1,800 residents, was cut off after floodwaters overtopped roads and bridges. Six were destroyed or severely damaged. Route 11 collapsed, isolating Kauai Hospital, the only such facility in the region. The Kauai region isn't the Hawaii of tourist fantasies. It comprises rugged mountains and thick vegetation, broken up by vast lava fields. Its communities are remote and are home to lifelong residents who scrape by, often living off the grid, and middle-aged and retired mainlanders who sought cheap land and a quiet place to start over. "It's not like you're going to drive up and go, 'Oh, wow, beautiful homes,'" said Carrie Frazier, an Ocean View resident. "These are people that are just trying to survive." In the parking lot of the Ocean View Market, Katie Tyner, who had suddenly become the gas lady, was standing next to the open hatch of her Chevrolet Trailblazer SUV, jotting down names and numbers on her clipboard. Her operation was simple and in high demand in a community where many do not own cars. Hand her cash and a fuel can, and she would return with gas from an operational station half an hour up the road. By noon, her Trailblazer had been filled with about a dozen red cans, each labeled in marker with the name and number of its owners. Ms. Tyner was preparing to go on her gas run soon. She had another critical mission: deliver fuel to people farther down the road in a town called Discovery Harbor, which was one of the hardest hit. Ms. Tynan had heard that residents there who rely on electricity to power their medical equipment were running out of fuel for generators. The town was inaccessible by the highway, but Ms. Turner, who has lived in Ocean View for 8 years, knew her way around. We have a little road we take, but it's a mudslide right now, so you have to have a four-wheel drive car, Ms. Tyner said. Next to Ms. Tyner's SUV, a pastor hugged a man who was in tears, then prayed over him. The pastor, Pamela Aiko, 70, who runs a church and volunteers with a community group that provides shelter and other assistance when disaster strikes, was passing out water bottles to anyone in need. One man handed Ms. Aiko a paper grocery bag filled with provisions. She set the bag on the ground and tore it open. She laid out the donated items: batteries, rope, rice flour, wet wipes, a first aid kit, and instant Korean noodles. There was also some ready-to-make turkey stuffing. If you guys are in need of anything, come get, Ms. Aiko announced to the people milling around the parking lot. One man grabbed the rope. Ms. Aiko invoked the Hawaiian principles of aloha, an ethic of love and compassion, and ohana, one of family and community. It's people helping people, Ms. Aiko said. This is when we come together as a family. You talk about aloha, you talk about ohana. This is what it's all about. Kahi Young, age 30, a hula teacher, had heard about the aid at the gas station and approached Ms. Aiko and other volunteers with a big ask. I need help getting everybody's attention right now, he said, and went group to group in the parking lot. Mr. Young had persuaded a helicopter tour company to make a drop of supplies in Pahala, about 25 miles away. In about 2 hours, the chopper would be landing at a nearby park, and he needed help filling it with as much as 700 pounds of supplies and non-perishable food. Ms. Aiko directed him to Mr. Reed, who handed Mr. Young a microphone so he could make his plea on the radio waves. The small blue helicopter touched down on a grassy park field. Volunteers filled it to the brim with boxes of baby wipes, toilet paper, and ready-to-eat food. Much came from Chris Cunningham, 48, who runs a food truck in Ocean View with her husband, and learns the art of hula from Mr. Young. She looked as the helicopter lifted off from the park with Mr. Young and the supplies on board. Mr. Young acknowledged her from the air. He flashed the shaka gesture, the extended thumb and pinky signal used on the island to say thanks or goodbye. Miss Cunningham, her dyed blue hair blowing in the rotor wash, shot up a shaka in return. That's how we do it down here, she said. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Family presses for information about fatal ICE shooting in Maine. The Department of Homeland Security said there would be an investigation, but so far little has been disclosed about the killing last month. This piece is written by Maya Spoto and Murray Carpenter. Murray Carpenter reported from Biddeford, Maine. The Department of Homeland Security said its inspector general would investigate an agent's decision to open fire on a Colombian immigrant last month in Maine, but scant information about the inquiry has frustrated the victim's family. The man, Johan Sebastian Duran Guerrero, was killed by an immigration agent during a July 13th confrontation in the coastal city of Biddeford. Neither the DHS nor Immigration and Customs Enforcement has said publicly whether Mr. Duran Guerrero, age 25, was the target of the enforcement operation. But the DHS defended the officer who opened fire, saying he had done so while, quote, fearing for public safety, unquote. In an effort to draw attention to the many unanswered questions, Democratic members of Congress held a public forum on Monday in Biddeford and were joined by Mr. Duran Guerrero's relatives in demanding more information. The auditorium where the forum was held was packed, with about 200 people, many of them wearing t-shirts and carrying placards critical of ICE. The crowd punctuated the lawmakers' comments with raucous applause and occasional chants of ICE out and abolish ICE. Representative Chelly Pingree, a Democrat of Maine, who organized the forum, said that the lack of video footage was concerning. If there were active body cameras on every law enforcement member who was participating there, we wouldn't be looking at some scratchy videos from one store that's over here, or one person that's standing in their doorway that's trying to get it, Ms. Pingree said at a news conference after the hearing. We would actually know every moment that happened at the scene. The shooting in Maine came less than a week after a fatal immigration encounter in Houston, and the two deaths prompted a fresh wave of attention on aggressive enforcement tactics by federal agents carrying out President Trump's mass deportation campaign. Ben Gideon, a lawyer representing the family of Mr. Duran Guerrero, said at the news conference that the man's partner, Carolina Rojas, has been interviewed by state investigators but had not been contacted by any of the federal agencies involved. Any reasonable investigation would include interviewing the family and eyewitnesses, Mr. Gideon said. The DHS has said that agents were monitoring what they believed to be the home of someone who was in the country illegally and had been issued a removal order. The DHS and the Department of Justice declined to answer direct questions about whether the killing was being investigated. The Justice Department referred the question to the DHS, which said that its Inspector General would investigate the discharge of the agent's firearm, but said nothing about investigating Mr. Duran Guerrero's death. Immigration agents have shot at more than 20 people during the Trump administration's immigration crackdown, including many who were in vehicles, some of them fatally. Mr. Duran Guerrero had a pending asylum application and a valid work permit and no removal order, Ms. Pingree said. Mr. Duran Guerrero had worked as a food delivery driver and a cleaner at a veterinary clinic. He and his partner had a 3-year-old daughter. Governor Janet Mills of Maine said at the hearing that she was heartbroken by the shooting, but that she was confident that the state attorney general, Aaron Fry, will conduct a thorough investigation. Mayor Liam LaFountain of Biddeford also addressed the officials. He said that Biddeford has been devastated by the shooting and that there has been no federal support to deal with the aftermath. The authority was federal, Mr. LaFountain said. The burden has been local. Omar Duran, Mr. Duran Guerrero's father, said he feels a deep pain when Mr. Duran Guerrero's daughter asks why her father doesn't come home from work. The death of Johann Sebastian under those conditions, at the hands of ICE, fills our community with fear and uncertainty, he said. That is why I ask only of God and of the justice system that my son's case be brought to light, along with the case of the many others who have had to go through something like this. Bond sell-off sends borrowing costs to highest level since 2007. Yields on the 30-year U.S. Treasury and government bonds across the world rose to multi-year highs as investors fret about inflation, deficits, and AI spending. This is by Joe Renison and Gregory Schmidt. Investor angst over stubborn inflation, unsustainable government deficits, and rampant spending on artificial intelligence helped send borrowing costs to multi-year highs across the world this week. The yield on the 30-year U.S. Treasury bond rose on Tuesday to 5.3%, its highest level since 2007. Similar bonds in Canada, Japan, Germany, and elsewhere also traded at their highest yields in at least a decade. The yields underpin interest rates on long-dated consumer borrowing, like mortgages, with the rise adding to everyday citizens' concerns over affordability that have taken hold both domestically and abroad. That is a problem for government leaders, including President Trump, whose administration has pointed to bond yields as a barometer of success in improving affordability. So far, Mr. Trump has shown no signs that he is willing to ameliorate two of the drivers of rising yields by either taking aggressive steps to rein in government borrowing or by quickly ending the war with Iran, which had been contributing to elevated fuel prices and inflation. A shaky ceasefire between the United States and Iran officially ended on Monday, dimming the prospects for a reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, a critical waterway for shipments of oil and gas from the Persian Gulf. When bond yields rise, it means prices are falling, and investors have worried for some time about increasing government spending, leading to a serious predicament, in which the government still needs to borrow money, but investors are unwilling or unable to lend it. Few analysts and investors have said they believe such a tipping point is imminent, but knowing exactly when or how it will occur in financial markets is practically impossible to predict, leaving investors and policymakers on edge. Matt Egan, a portfolio manager at Loomis Sayles, said that everyone knows that fiscal spending is unsustainable. The government's total debt is approaching $40 trillion, up roughly $5 trillion in 2 years. You are on a bus called the 30-year bond, and there is a cliff coming, but you don't know if it is 100 meters away or 100 miles away, he said. You are hoping you can get off the bus before it crashes. That is the conundrum we face. When Mr. Trump initially announced his tariffs last year, yields jumped sharply higher. The president quickly paused his sweeping tariffs in April last year, after he described the bond market as getting yippy. Mr. Trump has not indicated any similar reversal on Iran, and on Tuesday said there were no open conversations taking place with the country's officials. The latest climb in yields has been more slow and steady, creating less immediate panic. And despite a disconcerting drop in the stock market on Tuesday, major indexes remain close to their record highs. Still, the U.S. Treasury recently stepped in to support Japan's currency from weakening, with analysts noting that the move may have been part of an effort to prevent Japan from selling its huge holdings of treasuries, which would have pushed U.S. yields higher. Fears have been amplified by a spate of borrowing by some of the biggest technology companies in the world, as they fund the build-out of AI infrastructure. Some analysts say the debt is drawing buyers away from the treasury market, meaning there is less demand for treasuries, which contributes to higher yields. But others say the AI debt binge is also fueling spending in the economy, driving growth and inflation expectations, also pushing yields higher. Geopolitical shocks, such as the Iran war, have added new worries over volatile oil prices and stubborn inflation, intensifying concerns in the bond market. Alongside unorthodox interventions in foreign markets, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has sought to limit the pressure on longer-dated Treasury yields by moving much of the government's new borrowing needs into short-dated bills that mature in less than 1 year. Other governments around the world have pursued similar measures. There are risks to this strategy, too, because it makes the country's debt costs more intertwined with short-dated interest rates controlled by the Federal Reserve. That means that the rise in interest rates to combat inflation could come with a sharp increase in the government's borrowing costs. Bessent is reaching for norm-breaking tools to bring down the borrowing rate, noted analysts at Eurasia Group. Analysts and investors have long warned that without more decisive actions from Congress to reduce government spending, these measures merely buy more time, rather than present a solution. Already, Japan's currency has started weakening again. And on Tuesday, the country's 30-year bond hit its highest yield on record since the country began issuing 30-year bonds in 1999. Hayden Panettiere grew up in front of the camera. It took a toll. The Heroes and Nashville star, who died Sunday at age 36, endured personal struggles that were compounded by her public profile. This is by Malia Mendez. At 11 months old, Hayden Panettiere appeared in a Play School toy train commercial. By age 4, she was a recurring character on the soap opera One Life to Live. In the decades that followed, she starred in movies and television shows. Rarely was she out of a job. But like many wunderkinds, Panettiere, who died on Sunday at age 36, frequently seemed burdened by her success. Her well-documented struggles with alcohol, drugs, body image, her family, her significant others, seem inextricable from the public scrutiny that lit up so much of her life. In an era of relentless paparazzi, with an appetite for celebrity breakdowns, naysayers were certain this young starlet would crash and burn, reads one description of This Is Me, A Reckoning, the no-holds-barred memoir that Panettiere released this year. Not one to disappoint, she did. Panettiere seemed to have recently made peace with her thorny story, telling the New York Times in May that she maintained a laundry list of aspirations, including directing and producing, perhaps a lifestyle brand. But on Monday, emergency responders who arrived at an apartment in Greenville, South Carolina, found Panettiere in cardiac arrest. A person with knowledge of the situation told the Times that an apparent drug overdose was the cause. Born in Palisades, New York in 1989, Panettiere rose to prominence as a child actor, before her starring role as the supernaturally gifted cheerleader Claire Bennett in the hit NBC sci-fi drama series Heroes. She was offered the job on the spot, she recalled in her memoir, writing, I thought my heart was going to explode with gratitude. Her newfound stardom led the paparazzi to wait for her outside the Universal Studios lot and chase her down the freeways of Los Angeles. The tabloids were ceaseless in their body shaming. After one magazine spread pointed out the cellulite on a then-teenage Panettiere, the actress fell into a years-long battle with body dysmorphia. When Panettiere was around 16, someone on her team slipped her a pill intended to keep her energy up for Heroes press appearances, she recounted in her memoir. Those happy pills, she said, were the gateway drug that ushered me toward the good of pharmaceuticals and the downfall of addiction. Panettiere's family life was tangled up with her work. Her mother, the former soap actress, Leslie Vogel, was a true momager, and her father, Skip Panettiere, complied, Panettiere wrote in her memoir. I know Dad had arguments between his head and his heart, with his heart questioning whether it was right to have his baby girl so busy all the time, being shuttled around from one audition to another, Panettiere wrote. But she said he appeared to justify the arrangement, citing, for example, all the children she could meet at auditions. In a statement on Sunday confirming Panettiere's death, her father called her an incredible light and a force of nature who brought immeasurable love and joy to all who knew her. Panettiere's relationship with her mother bore the hallmarks of a business transaction, she told Jay Shetty on his On Purpose podcast. She was my boss, Panettiere said. That's how I saw her. She added that she felt she had to succeed professionally to earn her mother's love, calling it a tough pill to swallow. When, at 19, Panettiere finally told her mother that she no longer wanted to work together, Vogel responded, "You owe me," and walked away, the actress said on the podcast. As a young woman in Hollywood, Panettiere also endured her share of predatory behavior. In her Heroes era, she said in her memoir, an unnamed Oscar-winning actor-director exposed himself to her at a party. Not long after, she had an encounter with an unnamed British singer-songwriter that she later told the journalist Jane Mulcurins was as close to being human trafficked as I have ever experienced. When she met Wadalir Klitschko, a professional boxer who became her longtime partner, Panettiere gravitated to how safe he made her feel, she said on the Tamron Hall talk show in May. I think my being with him actually ended up protecting me, she said. But there, too, she could hardly catch a break. After Panettiere gave birth to their daughter in 2014, she began to suffer from postpartum depression. That led to substance abuse issues that eventually forced her to take a hiatus from Nashville, an ABC and CMT drama about country music singers in the Tennessee capital. She would split up with Klitschko and lose custody of her daughter. All along, the filming of Nashville had become traumatizing for Panettiere, as the show's writers used her real-life struggles to inform her character's story. But as she told the Times this year, she did as she was told, just as she always had. That was ingrained in me from a very young age, she said. I was a soldier. Never for a second did I think to say, hey, I'm not comfortable with this. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. In the opinion section, this is a guest essay titled, I'm a Psychiatrist. I'm Hearing Something New from Young Women. It's by Suzanne Garfinkel Crowell. Dr. Garfinkel Crowell, a psychiatrist, is the author of the forthcoming book titled, Girlhood Translated, Understanding Young Women in the Age of Therapy Speak and Self-Diagnosis. Several years ago, I started noticing something new when teenage girls or young women came to my office for their first psychiatric sessions. Patients used to dread being told that there was something, as they saw it, wrong with them. Now these young women were announcing their diagnoses: attention deficit, hyperactivity disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, anxiety, depression, almost before telling me their names. They had researched their symptoms on Instagram. They had taken TikTok quizzes about them. They had cross-indexed their conditions with those of their friends. It was everyone: gravel-voiced film majors and earnest high school athletes, class presidents and girls who skipped school, girls who spent weekends in the Hamptons, and girls who had to work for their spending money. The patients of this new wave were talking in therapy speak, and their therapy hadn't even started. The physician part of me would instantly start thinking through an alphabet soup of treatments for the conditions these girls were reporting: DBT, CBT, and EMDR, and medications to go with each. Another part of me, the parent, the exennial, would struggle to suppress an inner eye roll. If you're a parent of an adolescent girl, you might have experienced your own version of these two reactions: either terror for your daughter's psychological well-being, or alienation from all the jargon. You might have even tried to convince your daughter that everything was fine. None of those responses set us up to hear what these girls and young women are trying to say. I've been listening to girls every day for years, and I've learned a few things that can help parents, therapists, and anyone else who struggles to communicate with young women as they describe some form of distress. It starts with accepting that diagnosis words may function differently for these young women from the way they do for others. They are not necessarily claims to cold scientific truths yoked to specific evidence-based treatments. Instead, research increasingly reveals these words are often a coping mechanism, an effort to find some accepted narrative in which to situate one's very personal pain. We should try to hear them that way. We should take the therapy speak, to borrow an expression, seriously, but not literally. One girl told me she had assigned herself a diagnosis of depression, which she later acknowledged she thought would make me care about her. Another girl was stuck on an ADHD diagnosis, mostly because it made her feel less alone by connecting her to a vocal and vibrant online community. Several young women insisted they fit the clinical definition for anxiety, because it was less scary to blame an inherent flaw in their brains than to explore the causes of their very real discomfort, which turned out to be a mix of anger toward their loved ones and guilt for having those feelings. Another girl said that she used her various self-diagnoses as a container for whatever felt like too much about her, allowing her to fulfill what she thought was the teenage female's highest calling, to be chill. In some cases, my patient's self-diagnoses were spot on. In many others, however, the psychiatric label seemed more like a compromise between uncomfortable feelings and the desire for social acceptance. Are these labels a source of strength or a straitjacket? Are they helping young women find help and acceptance, or standing in the way? The answer isn't so simple. Adolescent girls and young women are not the only ones reaching for therapy speak, of course. According to some measures, 50% of Gen Zers have labeled themselves with mental health conditions, and illness identities have taken hold of young people, both online and off. But girls are by far the primary drivers of this trend. They are the main group looking up health information online, talking about their feelings and relationships, and seeking labels for what's wrong. They are also the demographic with the worst mental health profile. I think the association with young women, a group so often dismissed as frivolous, is a big part of why therapy speak is regarded as a sign of weakness and self-indulgence. As for therapists, we think about psychiatric diagnosis a lot less than you might imagine. That's partly because categories in our field tend to be more flexible than those in other areas of medicine. Classifications often evolve and change over time, especially for young people, and most of all for young women. Besides, no two people experience these conditions in exactly the same way, so we always have to try to understand the person first. Therapy speak, leading with diagnostic language, applying labels instead of describing feelings, can make that hard. It can leave friends and loved ones feeling they have no ability to help, as though they've got to back off and let the professionals do their thing. And it can short-circuit a young person's already difficult progress of self-discovery. To be clear, I'd still rather live in a world where everyone talks about trauma too much than one where you'd get shoved in a locker for being different. Ideally, we should create an environment in which girls can stop blaming their own brains for every problem and where they don't feel they have to be sick to be heard. Until they have access to a more nuanced lexicon of human troubles, however, we need to listen differently. Small acts of translation can help. Someone who says she has ADHD may or may not fit the clinical definition, but she's probably telling you she feels scattered, overwhelmed, or afraid she's a mess. If someone says she has anxiety, you can be pretty sure she's nervous, uneasy, or unsure of herself. If the word depressed freaks you out, consider instead why the person using it feels hopeless, lonely, or in despair. If you're sick of hearing every classmate, roommate, or ex described as toxic, look past the cliche and consider the harm it's meant to describe. Whatever works, gently offer that less literal meaning back to her. Not to challenge her words, but to understand them. Not to see if she really has a particular diagnosis, but to see what's going on beneath it. This kind of translation is a quiet process, but changes the way you show up, the energy you bring. With teenagers, that's always half the battle. Being too reactive makes it about you and your fears. Being too quick to reassure can make you seem you don't understand the seriousness of her concerns. Searching beneath the buzzwords for what she's really telling you avoids both pitfalls. Ultimately, translation is an exercise in empathy, in jumping out of the limits of your own perspective. Making that effort is a powerful way to help another person feel better. Language can illuminate certain parts of the truth while obscuring others. Perhaps that's why it is believed that Claude Monet said that in order to see a thing, we must forget its name. Internet users might have been getting at something similar when they came up with the hashtag, "Let's normalize not calling women crazy." When it comes to therapy speak, whether it's used in my office or in your house, this kind of translation is an important first step. This is a guest essay titled, "The Meaning of the $20 Burrito That's Tearing MAGA Apart." It's by Justin Wolfers. Mr. Wolfers is a professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan. A burrito shouldn't cost $20. That observation from a college student was picked up in early August by a conservative activist who set off a firestorm in the magosphere. Some told the buyer to suck it up and make smarter choices, while others warned that the GOP was not addressing voters' concerns about affordability, and that Republicans might pay for it in the midterm elections. Beneath the guacamole, though, is a genuinely interesting economic puzzle. An astonishing 95% of Americans say there's an affordability crisis. But is there? The Consumer Price Index tracks a giant basket filled with all of the goods and services that most Americans buy. A basket that includes groceries, healthcare, rent, gasoline, haircuts, Netflix, and yes, burritos. Dividing your paycheck by the cost of this basket tells you how many such baskets you can afford. By most measures, most Americans can afford more than they could a few years ago. Their inflation-adjusted wages have increased, although wages have yet to catch up to the recent Iran-related surge in energy prices. Which brings us to the puzzle. Americans are convinced they're living through an affordability crisis. So who's more on the mark, the economic statistics or the student who set off the MAGA burrito chorus? My first instinct as an economist is to trust the stats. But using statistics to patiently explain to people that their feelings are wrong rarely works. Believe me, I've tried. There's a different way to understand what people mean when they talk about affordability, which is more about the psychology of inflation than the economics. Let's consider my own story. My university employer gave me a modest raise this year. Naturally, I believed that I deserved this as a just reward for the fact that I had economized really hard. It felt good to be rewarded. Then prices rose and inflation ate away my gains. That felt different, like theft. I felt that I had earned that extra purchasing power. Now some dark and personal force had taken it from me. Of course, the economist part of my brain knows what really happened. My employer grudgingly gave me a cost of living adjustment, leaving my real income roughly unchanged. Economically, this was a wash. Psychologically, I experienced it as a play in two acts. First, a career triumph, then the painful theft of most of my hard-won raise. The key economic variable causing this pain was not how much stuff I could afford. That had barely changed. My pain was caused by inflation. That's why talk of an affordability crisis is better understood as being about the psychological hangover from rising prices. I'm not alone. We all have our own mental models about how inflation works, and those models are quite different from those in our economics textbooks. Stephanie Stantcheva of Harvard has run large-scale surveys asking Americans about their experience with inflation. A commonly stated fear is that inflation will create financial hardship. People often worry about affording housing or food. These responses conflict with economic theory and experience. After bursts of inflation, wages and prices tend to rise roughly in tandem, at least on average. Sometimes wages move first, other times prices do. But pretty quickly, they tend to move one for one. The empirical evidence is clear. The amount of stuff you can afford is generally not determined by inflation to any meaningful degree. If your output sells for a higher price, you're worth more in dollar terms to your employer. If you don't get a raise, a competitor might offer you a higher wage. In due course, the amount of stuff you can afford is restored. That's classic economics, but many Americans aren't buying it. They see their wages as determined by their bosses rather than market forces. And bosses don't like to raise wages, despite price increases. Under that model, inflation really would destroy affordability. Prices rise, wages don't adjust, and your paycheck buys less. That's how anxiety about inflation translates to concerns about affordability. The solution is obvious to people: lower prices. President Trump won the 2024 election after promising to immediately bring prices down starting on day one. He did not. That's what the burrito discourse is really about. The burrito brouhaha indicates that people on the right are finally seeing through Mr. Trump's false promises. In 2024, he read the public mood accurately, even as he got the economics wrong. Reducing inflation is costly, but reducing prices is even more costly. And for what? Lower prices would probably bring lower wages, leaving affordability unchanged. The burrito discussion is helpful because it reduces the economy to something you can wrap your hand around and taste. You can see the aluminum foil wrapper, subject to a 50% tariff. You can taste the Mexican tomatoes, carrying their own 17% tariff. You might be chewing on Aussie beef, which has been tariffed, untariffed, threatened with another tariff, and then exempted. The avocados for our guac come tariff-free from Mexico because of a U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement exemption, and those exemptions appear to be at risk. The cheese and sour cream come from American farms, which are struggling with worker shortages after immigration and customs enforcement raids. And I would pass on the lettuce until food safety is improved. No wonder people aren't happy about the price. Minnesota sues Texas governor over his refusal to extradite ICE agent. A federal agent facing assault charges in Minnesota has been jailed in Texas since May. Governor Greg Abbott has not granted an extradition request. Minnesota's Attorney General on Tuesday sued Governor Greg Abbott of Texas over his refusal to extradite an ICE agent facing assault charges in connection with a shooting during the Trump administration's immigration crackdown in the state. The agent, Christian Castro, has been held at a jail in South Texas since May on an arrest warrant issued by the county prosecutor in Minneapolis, where he faces four felony assault charges. Prosecutors in Minnesota accused Mr. Castro of firing a shot through the front door of a Minneapolis duplex on January 14th after a high-speed chase. The shot wounded a Venezuelan immigrant, Julio C. Sosa Celis. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement suspended Mr. Castro upon determining that the agent falsely claimed that he fired his weapon after three assailants brutally assaulted him with a broom and a shovel. Surveillance video that captured the incident contradicted that account. Mr. Abbott, a Republican, has not responded to an extradition request from his counterpart in Minnesota, Governor Tim Walz, a Democrat. Under Texas law, a person may be held on an extradition warrant for up to 90 days, which means that if no action is taken soon, Mr. Castro, 52, could be released before the end of the month. Governor Abbott is trying to shield Castro from being held accountable for these serious charges by refusing to extradite him to Minnesota, Keith Ellison, Minnesota's Attorney General, said in a statement. Mr. Abbott's inaction, he added, violates federal law and Texas law. In an email, Agatha Sarasa, a spokeswoman for Mr. Abbott, declined to comment. The lawsuit contends that governors have an obligation to turn over a person wanted on a criminal warrant from another state once the person's identity is confirmed. Minnesota officials said it was exceedingly rare for governors to ignore extradition requests. Mr. Abbott has approved several other Minnesota extradition requests in recent weeks, Mr. Ellison said. Mr. Ellison and Mary Moriarty, the elected county attorney in Minneapolis, said that officials in Mr. Abbott's office told them this week that the governor did not intend to act on the request to send Mr. Castro to Minnesota. Ms. Moriarty's office believes Mr. Castro could flee to Mexico if he is released, she said. She cited unspecified links she said the agent had to that country. We do believe he is a flight risk, she said during a news conference. Mr. Abbott has long argued that states should help enforce federal immigration law. Mr. Walz and Mr. Ellison, also a Democrat, have been stridently critical, of the Trump administration's immigration policies. The lawsuit, filed in federal court in the Southern District of Texas, asks a judge to order Mr. Abbott to sign the extradition order. If that doesn't happen immediately, the Attorney General's office is asking the court to block Mr. Castro's release from custody until the extradition matter is resolved. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. It's crunch time again for Canada to avoid new U.S. tariffs. Canada is seeking a deal to dodge further economic pain at the hands of the Trump administration on Midnight Tuesday. But at what cost? This is by Martina Steves-Gridneff, reporting from Toronto. Canada is bracing for a U.S. tariff deadline arriving at midnight on Tuesday, when a number of new levies by the Trump administration will come into effect unless negotiators strike an 11th-hour deal. The United States Trade Representative Jamison Greer, who is heading the talks for the U.S. side, said last week that the negotiators were reviewing options and that he expected Canada to drop certain measures it had already taken in response to U.S. tariffs. "If a country retaliates against us, we're obviously not going to tolerate that," Mr. Greer told reporters in Iowa on Friday. "We'll take action. My sense is the Canadians want to have a more conciliatory approach, but we'll see." Prime Minister Mark Carney has instructed Canadian officials who stayed in Washington over the weekend to continue talks with their U.S. counterparts to offer targeted concessions in order to both keep the new tariffs from taking effect and to ease existing levies on key Canadian goods. It's a tall order. President Trump has been sharply focused on squeezing Canada through tariffs, and this month he increased his belligerent rhetoric toward the country, the United States' closest ally and second largest trading partner, calling its leadership nasty. Mr. Carney and Mr. Trump spoke by phone Monday, a spokeswoman for Mr. Carney said, without providing further details. What are the tariffs being negotiated? The new tariff threat comes amid a breakdown in the United States-Canada-Mexico Free Trade Agreement, which the Trump administration declined to fully renew, prompting annual reviews. This has set the stage for a permanent state of flux in the most important trade relationships the United States has, and the decades-old trade order in North America. On top of that turmoil, in July, the Trump administration said it planned to impose new tariffs of 50% on more than 500 Canadian goods, including hockey sticks and cheese. Those add up to $20 billion worth of annual trade, about 2% of the entire goods traded between the two neighbors. Certain key Canadian industries are already under a separate set of tariffs, which Canadian negotiators want to see significantly eased in these negotiations. Those include tariffs of up to 50% on steel, aluminum, and autos. A variety of tariffs also affect Canadian softwood lumber. Wine and cheese are on the table. Mr. Greer has made it clear that the United States expects Canada to take a number of steps if a deal is to be reached. They include adjusting quotas for the duty-free entry of American dairy products into Canada's tightly protected market, dropping Canada's 25% retaliatory tariffs on U.S. autos, and restoring the sale of U.S. liquor in the government-controlled monopolies that distribute alcohol across most Canadian provinces. Canadian officials, speaking on condition of anonymity to discuss the state of the confidential talks, said that these were things Canada was prepared to do, but only in exchange for substantial improvements in the sectoral tariffs on Canadian goods exports to the United States, not merely for scrapping the threatened new round. Carney doesn't want mini deals. Mr. Carney wants an agreement that will ease the pain on the Canadian economy and stave off new tariffs, but he has indicated that he is not prepared to make concessions in exchange for a series of mini deals that he would need to renegotiate down the line. Canadians, particularly those who voted for Mr. Carney, are also loath to see Mr. Trump gain concessions through the repeated threats of tariffs. Canadians elected Mark Carney to both stand up to Trump while also trying to negotiate a deal, or negotiate down the tariffs, and I don't think those are mutually exclusive, but it is a narrow path for sure, said Brian Clough, a former senior official in Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's government. Mr. Carney has already made a number of concessions at various flashpoints over the past year, but he finds himself again facing the threat of more tariffs. After Mr. Carney took office last spring, Canada dropped some retaliatory tariffs that Mr. Trudeau had put in place. The government canceled an online tax that was anathema to the U.S. tech industry and agreed to share revenues from a new bridge connecting Detroit with Ontario, despite the fact that Canada had paid for it entirely, after Mr. Trump threatened to block the bridge's opening. What are the possible outcomes? There are three scenarios for where things could land when the clock strikes midnight. One, a deal. Canada and the United States could reach an agreement that involves Canadian concessions in exchange for scrapping the new tariffs and easing the existing ones. Two, no deal. The new 50% tariffs would come in and the old ones would stay in place. Three, deal delayed. A full compromise would not be reached by midnight, but enough progress would have been made to allow the United States to push back the threatened new tariffs, to give negotiators more time. The second scenario would herald further escalation, Mr. Clough said, as it would most likely lead Mr. Carney to put in place new retaliatory measures and reclaim negotiating power. If the U.S. decides to proceed with imposing these new tariffs tomorrow, Canada, although this current government has eased back on retaliation, will have to respond in some way, Mr. Clough said. Elizabeth Smart wants us to see the magnitude of resilience. Her abduction as a child became a national story. In a new true crime podcast, Smart speaks to survivors of violent crimes about what they endured and the lifelong process of healing. It might not seem like Elizabeth Smart, whose 2002 kidnapping became one of the most high profile in history, would want to immerse herself in stories of similar horrors. She doesn't see it that way at all. On a new podcast, The Survivor Files with Elizabeth Smart, Smart speaks with survivors of violent crimes to explore not just what happened, but what came after, including the ongoing process of healing. For the first episode, she sat down with Kara Robinson Chamberlain, who escaped a serial killer at age 15. The determination to continue moving forward, finding that inner strength, that's the part that just really speaks to me, Smart recently told the New York Times in a conversation about the 48-episode weekly series, which debuted on Monday through iHeart Podcasts. Smart was 14 when she was kidnapped in the middle of the night from her bedroom in her family's Salt Lake City home by Brian David Mitchell. She was then held captive and brutally abused by him and his wife, Wanda Barzi, for 9 months before being rescued. Now 38, Smart lives outside Salt Lake City with her husband and three children. She has long worked to raise awareness around issues of child safety, sexual assault, and trauma recovery, in part through the Elizabeth Smart Foundation. And she says this podcast feels like the next meaningful step. There's nothing more powerful than when the survivor of the story is the person sharing their story, she said. Here are edited excerpts from our conversation. This podcast is a bit of a hybrid, part documentary style, part intimate conversation. Why was this the best format for you to examine such stories? It is very important for our listeners to understand the magnitude of not just the stories, but of the people themselves, what they've been through. So we have our guests walk us through, beat by beat, what happened. What was going through their mind? How did they feel in that moment? What did they think was going to happen next? Did they think anyone else was aware? So our listeners can feel connected and understand just how important the resiliency and the moving forward part is. Because if you don't understand the depth of how dark it was, how can you understand how incredibly bright they shine now? It's really easy when we hear other people share stories to sit there and be like, well, why didn't they do that? Well, why didn't they do this? As a survivor myself, I understand where the curiosity comes from, but I also understand how hurtful it can be hearing someone be like, well, why didn't you run? Why didn't you scream? So when we have a survivor sharing what happened, it's much easier to be like, okay, I understand what was going through your mind. I understand why that wasn't an option. As someone who has been interviewed extensively for decades, what changes for you when you step into the role of interviewer? My number one concern is just making sure that people feel comfortable because they are sharing the worst moments of their life with me. If they're feeling too emotional, if they feel like this is too hard, I will always tell them, do we need to step away from this? I'll say, if I ask you a question and you don't want to answer it, you don't want to talk about it, just tell me. That is fine. This is your story. We want it in your words. I'll tell my guests, if you have a better question for me to ask or a better way to ask that question, please tell me. Has there been a moment when a guest said something that changed or expanded your perspective on healing? I've been saying it for years, but it just brought me new meaning, reaffirmed it to me. Having interviewed survivors of all sorts of horrific nightmares and just unimaginable things, there is no timeline on healing. Maybe that's one of the most important messages that this podcast will put out there, because we have guests on who experienced something 50 years ago, and it's still a work in progress. There is no magic formula. We're all just doing the best we can. We all have to find our own way forward, and we're not alone. There are others around us. What is one recurring theme about human resilience that has stood out to you most across these episodes? Certainly just the strength of humanity is incredible. It's so common, I have people come up to me and say, I could never go through what you did. And honestly, if I heard someone share my story and it wasn't me, I'd probably think the same thing. But you don't know how strong you are until you're going through something. That's true of every person that I've interviewed. Nobody thinks they're that strong until they don't have another direction to go in, until they are forced to be that strong. It's about taking that next step, that next breath, making it through that next minute. Your case received extraordinary media coverage, but thousands of missing persons, particularly Indigenous, Black, and marginalized individuals, never get a fraction of that attention. How do you feel about what's been coined missing white woman syndrome in the true crime space? They're not wrong. If I had not been white and blonde and grown up in an affluent neighborhood, would my story have gotten the attention that it did? No, it wouldn't. It's not fair. It's not right. So absolutely, I want to share stories of people from every walk of life, because it shouldn't just be reserved for the white blonde women of the world. Also, at the end of the day, I'm not going to be sorry that my case received the attention that it did, because I'm here. I'm alive. Do we need to do that more? 1,000% yes. Do we need to change? So much change needs to happen. But I will forever be grateful for the attention that my case got. The true crime genre and its fandoms have a reputation for crossing boundaries. What do you think about this voyeuristic appetite? There is a line to walk. I also find it very interesting that for many people, that's the last thing they watch or listen to before they go to bed at night. How do I make sense of that? I mean, I can't. But then I am immersed in the world of fighting sexual assault and violence and abuse and kidnapping. So that's kind of my day-to-day. But I certainly don't want it to be the last thing I think of before I go to sleep. That interview was conducted by Maya Salam, who is an editor and a reporter, focusing primarily on pop culture across genres. You have been listening to a reading of articles and features from the August 18th issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Jim Michaeli. Thank you for listening.